Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schooler.
I'm guilty as charged. What can I say? It's a real pleasure today to be joined by Mark S.A. Smith and Tom Leonard as well. Thank you so much for joining us. I'll just give you guys a quick introduction. So Mark has had a successful career in helping to bring to market billions of dollars of disruptive technology. He now works with vision makers to turn market challengers into market leaders. And he's at work with C-suite leaders determined to transform their business from a market challenger into the market leader in 3 years or less. And we will share the details on his website at the end of the show. So Tom Leonard is over in Burbank, California, and he's the creator and host of the Gamers Change Lives podcast, a show that highlights how esports entrepreneurs around the world can create jobs in their community. He's got an MBA from Stanford Graduate School of Business, marketing experience in entertainment at Netflix and Warner Brothers. So as part of the series that we're doing right now, the fifth series on Influential Visions, we're going to be basically talking about jobs and really in the technology space as a whole. But obviously, you know, you guys, we kind of talked a little bit before the show about perhaps talking about sales and marketing jobs. And I think that's probably a good place to kind of focus this conversation around, to be honest. Because I think, you know, with Web 3.0, with all of this hyperbole of excitement that's kind of happening right now, I think that sales and marketing jobs are probably going to still be there, but I think they will probably change in some way. So what do you think, Mark? Are you excited about the sort of changes that are happening at the moment, or are you a bit kind of bored, like a lot of people, like myself as well?
All change is good just because it flushes out those who have become complacent. And we can never advance the state of our being unless we are stepping outside of our comfort zone. All right, enough of the blah, 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 rah, rah, rah stuff. The reality is that marketing is the most misunderstood word in business. What is marketing? Oh, we have a website. No, that's not marketing. Oh, we have a PDF brochure. No, that's not marketing. No, pray not. Well, we do cold calling to reach out to customers, which is one of the things that we're getting more and more automation around. No, that's not marketing. Well, what the hell is marketing? It's everything you do to trigger a conversation with somebody who's likely to buy from you. And everything you do that lets them know what the hell it is that you can do that changes their life so they want a conversation with you. That's marketing. All those things I talked about are tactics. The strategy behind marketing is to trigger a conversation either with one of your people or with your web property. And if it doesn't trigger a conversation with a person or a web property, you are throwing your money down the toilet. Send it my way.
Yeah, that's a good explanation. So what do you think, Tom? Are you kind of excited about Web 3.0 and the changes that are happening, or are you not?
What I like hearing what Mark was talking about, the definition of marketing is really, really good because it is misunderstood. And everyone's like, oh, I'm in marketing. Oh, okay. It's like, and then, you know, I think one of the things I like hearing him say, it's about starting a conversation. And I think maybe I heard him say, start a conversation, which is really, really good because it's not a one-time deal. Good marketing is something we used to do it, you know, all the time. I started in email marketing before I was doing email marketing before there was spam. I mean, that's how long ago it was, but we always called it a dialogue. It's like, we weren't doing the email marketing. I mean, that's what we're sending emails, but we really wanted to create a dialogue and start talking to people via email in that case, because it's not something that happens just once, hopefully. And, you know, it more and more people are, you know, you want to build that relationship over time.
Well, that's what's required to create the trust that so for somebody to buy from you, because when you were doing email marketing, nobody knew who the hell you were. And nobody's going to buy in the first outreach because there's way too much risk, or they don't even know what it is that you sell. They don't know what the benefit is to their life. And so that dialogue is required for them to get an idea of why should I pay attention to you and why should I trust you? And that gets back to the best formula for emails, which is you have to answer four questions right now. Number one, why are you bothering me? I got stuff to do. Why are you bothering me? Answer that right now. The next question you have to answer is who cares? You better call me up by name, or you better call me up by title. Or you better call me up by role. You better call me up by function. You better call me up by interest. The third one is why should I trust you? Why should I believe you? Because if I can't believe you, I'm done. And then the fourth thing we have to make sure we ask for is why should I do anything? So with those four things, you leave any of them out, you haven't got any marketing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So do you think that that marketing jobs are just going to continue along the same trajectory of just becoming more and more segmented in the way that they are? So more and more specialists and perhaps less and less strategic kind of marketers? Or, I mean, I think it's best we talk about marketing separately to sales. Otherwise, I'm going to get confused myself. So what do you guys think on that one?
Well, as far as marketing changing, I think that's an interesting concept to be talking about, because on one hand, it does need to change as technology changes. But on the other hand, I'm always amazed how little it changes over time. It's like one of the things that we discovered, certainly at Netflix. One of the things, because when I was starting out, I was doing all the email marketing there to get the first 50,000 subscribers to the service, which now they're like at hundreds of millions out there. But we had to get the first 50,000 to do the funding guidelines, to meet the funding guidelines. So we were doing that with email. But it was just, it's kind of the same concept over and over again. I always call marketing at Netflix as the one trick pony. I mean, it's a really nice pony, but you're kind of doing the same thing over and over and over again. And, you know, you can test all kinds of things out there. So I guess on one hand, I'm always surprised how little things change. The tactics, the vehicles, the tools that you might have might change a little bit. But the other thing that also always comes to mind is that it takes someone from the outside to disrupt things. It's like, if you expect, it's just, at Netflix, you know, the example I always use there is we should have been afraid of Blockbuster. Blockbuster had 284 million customers with this incredible history of rental background. And it's like, when we were starting out, we didn't have anything. But they should have been able to take that and blown us out of the water. But they couldn't, because they had the brick and mortar stores. We knew that. We knew they could not walk away from that. So we weren't afraid. So you need... The disruption needs to come from someone outside. And the other thing I always think of is Tesla. I mean, you know, General Motors, you know, could have made, you know, any of the car manufacturers could have made an outstanding electric vehicle if they'd wanted to, but they chose not to. And so it's someone from the outside that does that disruption.
I absolutely agree with you, Tom. You know, we need to talk about marketing rather from three different levels: strategic, managerial, and then tactical deployment. And strategy will never, ever go away, or you're essentially going to mess yourself up seriously. You have to have a direction. You have to have a purpose. And if you don't have a marketing strategy, in fact, if you don't have a defined marketing strategy, you don't have any marketing. It is chef's choice soup. Whatever you got laying around is what you're doing. And I guarantee you're not going to get the results you need. So it starts off with marketing strategy. I doubt if marketing strategy, the fundamentals of marketing strategy, will ever change, because we're still communicating with human beings. And those things will never change. There might be some variations on a theme, but it won't change. The next level is the managerial, which is the deployment of how we sequence out the tactics to get the marketing into play. And that requires somebody who understands how all these tactical deployments work together and how they what they do. Each one of these things has a specific function. A website has a function. An email list has a function. A telephone outreach has a function. Chat has a function. There's functions everywhere to solve specific issues in creating those conversations with our customers. What I see changing the most is the tactics. And as we move into this, we're going to do more and more probably interruption-based marketing. I'm really, really surprised that Netflix and Amazon haven't done more interruption-based marketing in the work that they do, since they can create video on the fly and they can generate video that they insert certain movies that includes product placement. And holy cow, the technology exists for that. Why the hell aren't they doing it right now? And since they know who the hell's watching, they can do product placement that is absolutely laser targeted to doing this. The server power exists right now to do that. So that may be one of the things that we'll see in the future with Web 3.0. And I also believe that we'll see a lot more AI influence, where we'll have an array of marketing tactics, and the AI, based on getting to know the person that we're targeting, is going to select the one that is the most effective for them in this moment. What is the one that's going to interrupt them the best in this moment? What's the messaging? We're going to get predictive analytics online. It's happening now. You know, heck, it happens at Netflix. What should I watch next? You get every time at the end of a show, you get a recommendation. That's AI suggesting what you should select next. And it is not random. It is based on your viewer history. That's the kind of changes in marketing that I expect for us to see.
Yeah, it's interesting you're talking about the Netflix recommendations. When I started there, I mean, that's when they started the recommendations, and the recommendations engine was so basic. Yeah. I mean, it was just like, it was, you know, we always tried to make it sound bigger and more intelligent. It only took a few movies and the rating a few movies, and you were going to get the same recommendations out of the system. It wasn't so. I think one of the things I've been a little bit surprised is how Netflix in particular hasn't used the data that they have quite as well as I thought that they probably would.
Well, interestingly, because iHeartRadio uses the data, listener data, to predict the next hit using predictive analytics, artificial intelligence. So they're getting really, really sharp at hit prediction.
No, I believe it. No, between the amount of data that Spotify or iHeartRadio or any of those, I mean, the amount of data that they have is just unbelievable. And and it also takes organizations, when you're talking about the managerial side of it, it takes an organization organized in a way to collect the data, but also to be able to use that data in some intelligent way, because those two don't always go together.
Well, and it gets even a little more complex. I like where we're going with this, because this is interesting. Predictive analytics can be used for strategic purposes, such as where in general shall we go, and tactical purposes. What should I do with this particular person? One of the things that we can do with predictive analytics today that I think will probably become ubiquitous, otherwise the companies are going to go out of business, is prediction of customer churn, which is a function of marketing, right? And so they will, by the behavior of the customer, like for example, they start stretching the usage to one less day a week, and they'll start to predict this is a person that's about to churn. And then they'll find out of these half a dozen churn prevention methodologies, let's give them a free month, let's give them a free t-shirt, let's give them a free back massage, whatever it happens to be. And then we'll figure out that, you know, here's how we interrupt a person deciding to leave by spending $5, $10, $15. And from a marketing standpoint, that's pure gold. Yeah, that absolutely. We'll see more of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day who was saying how much more expensive it is to actually get someone into a webinar. I mean, he does a lot of work with his company, with IBM and Oracle and, you know, various technology companies, right? And basically the price of getting someone into a webinar is through the roof now. It's completely, I think he was saying like it's like £100 or something is roughly the figure he was quoting me. for getting someone just into a webinar. And that's not even like, they're not even a qualified person, right? Like they might buy something, they may be interested, right? It's not even a qualified lead here, right? So the whole thing is kind of moving into this different way of interruption. I think you're right in saying that, Mark. I think people are very sick of receiving communications. I think that the faster we approach, you know, proper contextualized wording, we optimize the wording. I've got a friend who's working with some AI that optimizes the wording that people use with campaigns, for example. So it will say, okay, well, these words that you're using are not going to resonate with your target audience. Okay, so there are all sorts of jobs that actually are around these kind of machine and person jobs, right? Like I know people that run chatbots, right? So you know, IBM and stuff, they were talking about chatbots like 7 years ago and everyone got really excited and everything. And it's just, it has not delivered, right? Like it's got to the point where, you know, you go and have a conversation with a chatbot, but actually it's just a lot of meaningless kind of jargon. It doesn't give you the answer to a very simple question in many cases. But I think that the people that go in and edit those transcripts, they are becoming, you know, much more valuable. And actually, it's kind of exciting. Like the whole way that it's evolving is very exciting. I'm kind of still a little bit on the fence about how it's going to work when it comes to like augmented reality, virtual reality. Those things have just not even really touched the surface yet. I mean, you know, when you get to the point of you can walk down the street and you've got your glasses on and you can look around and you can see what it looked like maybe 5,000 years ago, and then you can perhaps book on a history tour, right, within the space of 5 minutes, right, because you're interested in some signage or something. That's exciting for me. That I think is the way that we're heading. But is it going to be fast enough to actually gain critical mass, or is it going to be just this case of just bored, fed up people with promises that this amazing world of VR is gonna happen for them, right? Because AR is different. You know, that's a separate thing. So what do you guys think about that sort of space?
Take it away, Tom.
Well, one of the things I was going to ask you guys is, when we're talking about productivity and AI and the use of AI, is there anyone out there outside of the streaming entertainment side of things? Is there anyone out there that's doing it right, that you're looking at and you're saying, wow, those guys really know what they're doing?
And probably.
And Amazon. I'm really good.
I think Amazon does a damn good job making me buy more stuff.
Absolutely. And it's not in an intrusive, pushy way. It's in a way, oh, actually, I need that. So I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem if I've got the money, right, at the time, and someone says to me, oh, I think you need this. And I'm like, actually, they know, like, I need these motorcycle gloves. I need this oil. I need some brake pads, and I need, you know, whatever it is. Doesn't matter what it is. But if it catches you at the right time, I think it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. It's a superb way of doing business. And Amazon are the company to watch, really, when it comes to this, to be honest.
Well, they do upsell by showing you something with a few more stars. And they do cross-sell with, this is usually bought with. And son of a gun, if those recommendations often aren't solid. I bought my girlfriend a new pair of ear pods because I wanted to hear her better. And the recommendation was to add the charger. And I said, the charger's not included? Hell yeah, we're getting the charger. You know, the transaction just was bumped up by 10 points because of that AI.
No, it's not rocket science. I mean, it's pretty basic stuff. And that's why it's always interesting to see who's out there already doing it. And the other part of it is always amazes me is just the amount of data that's required to do those things. Yeah. I mean, that, of course, Amazon can have all the data in the world, but just to be able to collect that, all those data points is pretty amazing.
To do a good job training AI, you need 70,000 experiences, 70,000 transactions to train the engine. And then after that, it'll have sufficient algorithms to do better than, you know, flipping a coin kind of response. But the good news about predictive analytics is it doesn't have to be my data. I can go out and open source data, or I can buy data about things that I want to know, I want to predict, that I have not yet been collecting data on. So the real secret is data augmentation to success in predictive analytics. I can go out there and buy, I can go out there and buy a record on any one of us that is extremely deep and complex, that'll let the world know that I do things like scuba dive. Let me know that I have a four-wheel drive truck. And then we can make correlations between a temperament for people that have four-wheel drive scuba trucks. You know? And then from that, we can get some predilection. For example, people know that scuba divers aren't afraid to take risks. They know how to risk mitigate. Four-wheel drive truck drivers usually know how to mitigate risk. They're willing to take risks, but they know how to mitigate it. So just, we can extract psychographic data from a person's experiences, and we'll see more and more of that by people that are going to dominate the market.
Yes. Well, one of the things that I have played around with before is with Facebook advertising. And when it comes to, if you have an audience that you can bring in, and then you can do the lookalike audiences, which, you know, it's just, I haven't been able to spend enough time or money to figure out exactly how good they are. But just the whole concept of then, just like you're saying, not using just my data, but taking my data and then using everyone else's data that is similar, and then getting me to spend more money with advertising with them. I think that's just phenomenal.
And if you get the lookalike parameters right, you know, the lookalike has to have the critical parameters that align. And because you can get lookalike audiences where the key parameters doesn't exist in the lookalike. And that's the part that you have to be very careful about is, am I getting the meaningful lookalike alignment? And otherwise, you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars searching for something that is not there.
And they're more than happy to take your money while you're learning.
Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you think about the next kind of wave then of jobs in terms of marketing jobs within technology as a whole? I mean, I think from where I'm sitting, I think it's gonna come to a lot more strategic roles in terms of like the way that they are managing the data. I mean, you can't just have a machine do it. You need to have that augmented approach where, you know, the data scientists and the data trained people, they don't necessarily have to be coders. They just need to actually have an analytical way of looking at things. I think it's going to be quite interesting in the way that things are going to evolve. I mean, there are those guys, there are the creatives as well, are always, you know, we're always going to need creatives. Yes, there are programs that can create imagery and everything else, but you still need people to direct those things at the moment anyway. Do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I think that what's going to happen is we're going to have fewer jobs at the tactical level and more jobs at the managerial directive level. The jobs at the strategic level will stay about the same, because that's the chief marketing officer's role, is to come up with a strategy with the CEO and the rest of the C-suite. And so what has to happen, though, is that if you're going to really do this right, you have to understand what strategy is. And so strategy is the second most misunderstood word in business. You can ask, as I have done, you know, on a webinar, 15 CMOs, what is strategy? And they all had a different answer. And so one of the challenges is strategy is something that has to be taught to you. It's not innate. Strategy is a skill that is not natural to the human being. We are hunters and gatherers. It's wired into our DNA. And so for most people, that strategy is a mystery. And sometimes they They have no idea how to go about it. But the reality is strategy is looking into the future and creating a path into the unknown. And that scares most human beings.
So I'm really curious, Mark, on the when you're talking to these CMOs, are they apprehensive about the future? Over time, what have you been seeing over time? Are people at that level more apprehensive or more excited about what's coming?
They're actually more excited than apprehensive. Now, keep in mind, when you get to the C, the chief suite, your job is to foresee the future. And if you can't, you have no business having a C title. That's why I say chief joy officers aren't a thing. But keep in mind that a chief marketing officer's horizon is quite short. It tends to be 1 to 2 years. Whereas a CEO's horizon is going to be 5 to 10, and if they're really good, 20. A chief revenue officer is going to be 1 to 2, depending if they have real estate acquisition in their future or not. It might be a little further out. And chief operating officers typically have 1 to 2 years horizon. Chief revenue officers, their horizon's very short, 1 year, maybe a little longer if they've got some serious growth plans. For most of these people, they're not looking far enough out into the future to really be afraid. It's the chief executive officer that's the one that you know usually has to pull their pants on and buckle their belt tight, because they're being asked to lead into a future that's chaotic, unpredictable. They have to direct the company to where the customer will be spending money in the future. That is really fundamentally the job of a CEO. And to essentially rip off Wayne Gretzky.
So when it comes to, I mean, I just out of interest, you know, I was looking into NFTs the other day, not to buy any, but just noticed an article about, I think it was Prada, who actually they'd launched like a very interesting limited edition series of t-shirts, which were accompanied by an NFT. I don't know if they sold the t-shirt first or the NFT first and it came with the t-shirt. I'm not quite sure. But I think that kind of digital and also physical approach is working quite well. And the reason I love NFTs is because actually the creator of that NFT will get paid for life if they resell that item. I think that is quite an exciting prospect for creators. How that is going to work when it comes to marketing and sales jobs, I think is going to be interesting. There are going to be some obviously strategic people who come up with this scarcity offer that is out there, because that's in essence that's what we're talking about here, right? It's like create a product, make it scarce, sell it for some good money, and then you're creating something that gives the press something to talk about. You're embracing a new technology, right? So I don't know, I'm looking at this and I'm saying, well, how do we make this connection with sales and marketing? Are marketing jobs taking away sales jobs? Are there going to be more sales jobs because of marketing and the way that marketing is changing? So then, you know, there are going to be more account directors who need to explain what the hell is going on in marketing. I think from where I'm sitting, that and what we've just talked about, you know, account directors are probably going to grow, whereas people who do the tactical work may shrink. So the middle management of actually the agency world, it may change in that department. What do you guys think on that, Mark? Do you want to go first on that one?
I'll be glad to. When it comes to NFTs, essentially it's the new Beanie Babies. My ex-wife has a huge collection of very, very valuable Beanie Babies worth absolutely nothing. It's forced scarcity into a market that was created by forced scarcity. They always, always, always fall apart. The tulip bulb mania in Holland back in the 1800s. The NFT is the latest version of the scam to make people, the fear of missing out, cause people to part money with the people that are creating the markets. NFTs have zero intrinsic value. Zero. There is zero. At least Beanie Babies was a toy you could toss to your dog.
So, Tom, what do you think
I'm on the skeptical side of NFTs. But the best one that I saw recently was an NFT of a Corvette. So you could buy this NFT, this little image of the Corvette, and they would give you the car. It's like, yeah, that's how much they were going to. It was such a great marketing gimmick there. You know, on one hand, I always think that, you know, who's, you know, are these things going to be valuable in the future? And I always go back to the video games that are, it's like, if someone told me that you could create a Battle Royale game out there and never charge for it, but only charge for people buying things to make it look better, not to enhance the experience. If you didn't, the person that's not spending a dime, it has the same ability to play, but they just don't look as good. And when you think of how much money, you know, Fortnite brings in, and all of the huge video games that are free to play, and so that kind of tells me that, you know, there's certainly some kind of market out there. And you know, the things that you buy on Fortnite, it's not NFTs, it's not quite the same thing, but it's still, people are interested in buying something there. And I think it also goes back to something that maybe you mentioned early on there, and that was about creative. It's like the creative side of things, or maybe it was you, Mark, but it's like the creative side is always going to be important, and no matter what. And it's you know, content is king. I mean, that will never change.
Absolutely true. Tom, I think you're onto something. The place that NFTs may happen is inside the gaming world, because gamers are all about prestige. It's all about leveling up. It's the infinite game. And, you know, you've identified that all the up levels are all based on increasing a person's prestige. Well, they can sell NFTs within that environment very easily, because the market already expects a level of prestige and rareness. So thank you for revealing to me that potential marketplace. I don't see it existing outside of any other passionate market space where prestige is the driving force for their behaviors.
Very interesting.
So getting back to the question that you asked, because I wanted to go down the NFT route.
yeah, I know you guys did. And I was like, okay, I've asked two questions there, so we'll see what happens, right? So back to the sales jobs, guys. Come on, back to the sales jobs. What do we think about the sales jobs and how they're going to change?
What'll happen is tactical sales jobs will disappear. They'll be replaced by chatbots. And a tactical sales job is somebody who says is providing information about a known commodity that the person is buying. It's not a sold product, it's a bought product. They're showing up to buy something, they have some questions, chatbot takes care of them. We don't need anybody to help us with that. Strategic sales will always be required, because we're talking about complex communications and we're talking about a lot of moving parts. And so, for example, IBM, HP, Oracle, NetApp will all always require a sales professional, because they have to navigate the complexity of the purchase. And many times they have products that are sold, and sold is something that's sold is where the salesperson is initiating the conversation. Products that are bought, the customer is initiating the conversation. So products that are bought, yep, we don't need you anymore. That'll all be automated. Products that are sold, at least at the higher end, the more mission critical products, will still need humans. Although I suspect that the AI is going to get pretty darn good. But keep in mind, when we're selling a product that's mission critical, the underlying factor that makes the decision is trust. And I don't know if we're going to get to a point where AI is going to engender trust in somebody for a while. That may happen in a few generations, but I don't think we're quite there yet. Tom, thoughts? I want to hear from you.
Yeah, I agree with you when you're talking about the tactical sales jobs are going to be disappearing. But I always go back to years and years ago when I first got out of school. I went to work for a department store here in Southern California called Bullock's. And I was fortunate enough to get to work at Bullock's Wilshire, which has this huge Art Deco building. It was the first suburban department store in the United States. And it's like, you know, just blocks from downtown, but they called it that. It's just just an incredible building. But when you look back what it was like when people shopped there when it opened in 1929, It's like the customer, the patron went in and they sat down and the merchandise was brought out to them. I mean, it's just like, the reason I'm bringing this up is we've been going down this road for years and years and years. I mean, you know, I have to go over here. I have to play checkout person over here at Pavilions. You know, it's just like, you know, they pretty much force you into that. Then they, you know, they don't like it when you're not very good at it. Sort of
thing. At least you're not stuck behind some grandma writing a check.
Yes. Yes. So, so you're the glass half full person. I can tell here.
Oh, no, I'm the glass is completely full of a mixed solution of air, water.
Whatever. Yes. Yes. So I think you're right. But the other thing is, I think even the big complicated sales, I think, are shifting because people are buying cars now in ways that they weren't buying them 20 years ago. It's like to think that people would actually go and buy a car online without seeing it. It's like, I mean, that would have never been that'd been crazy before. It's like, how do you know you're going to like it? And I think even the really big complicated personal purchases, I guess it also goes back to just exactly what Mark was saying. It's trust. It's like, I'm not going to buy a car online from, you know, Joe's used car website sort of thing, but I might buy it off of CarMax because I bought cars there before and I trust them on what they're on how they, on the cars that they handle. So there's a level of trust there. So I think you're on the right track there. It's that level of trust that is so critical to make it work.
Well, and also CarMax gives you the guarantee. You have 5 days to drive the darn thing. And if you hate it, hand us back the keys and, you know, you don't even have to wash it. I think that in these online situations, the person has tried on the car someplace somewhere before they bought it. They have a friend has a car and they've bought, you know, like I love Audis and Toyotas and I'll buy anything from Audi and Toyota because I know it's going to blow my mind for different reasons. And so I could go online and select that. I could do that, but that's just because of the history that I have and the trust that I've already built. So I think online complex sales is going to happen only after the brand is firmly established and with a great parachute that prevents the buyer from incurring any risk whatsoever from that online purchase.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. So are we sort of agreed then that marketing jobs are going to become more strategic, more interesting? People are going to hopefully have to work less, is my personal opinion. I think we're, you know, I've been talking a lot about this recently. We're in a productivity revolution. We're actually in a technology revolution that people seem to think is kind of finished. But I think we're right at the beginning of this. And you know, for example, you've got these AI copywriting tools that are, you know, incredibly good. And they, you know, you can write amazingly good content using these tools. We've got all sorts of amazing transcription tools whereby, you know, you can have a note taker in your meetings. And that note taker, you can mark very interesting moments during the meeting, and it will save those specific moments, which I think is just so great because it means you can also have a proper conversation without saying, well, hold on a minute, I'm going to write a note, and you completely got distracted and you made a note, right? But actually, you could just click insight or, you know, review item or whatever tag you've got on that particular space, right? But those are only two things that I've mentioned, right? And there are infinite numbers. So my opinion is, for what it's worth, is I think it's going to become a lot more segmented in experience levels. I think that people who are doing these tactical jobs are going to become a lot more specialist in those specific jobs. And I think that they're going to be a lot more like boot camps, which is like, oh, okay, I need to learn this new skill for this new job. I'm going to go away and I'm going to learn this new skill. And when I come back, I'm going to be, you know, two weeks full training, and I'm going to come back and my mind is going to be, you know, at one with the machine that I've kind of been working on in my opinion. And I think that it's going to be quite exciting. I think that being in a marketing job right now is very exciting. I wouldn't want to be particularly in a sales job right now, unless I was like top of my game in that particular space. I think that it would be quite hard, but that's my opinion, right?
Now, keep in mind that mission critical salespeople are some of the highest paid people on the planet.
Yeah.
And so get over yourself if you want to make that kind of money.
Yeah.
I think that you're right in that the tactical jobs are going to essentially be pushed into the hands of our, you know, single digit VAs, single digit dollar VAs who are really good at learning a specific tactical skill. And they're really good at staying up to date on that. And the whole thing is it's a moving parade. That tactical level is rolling at about a 12 to 18 month cycle, where what you learned 18 months ago ain't worth anything to you right now. And so, yes, those jobs will continue, and a lot of those will become automated. If you can give a person a checklist and they can get the task done in 5 minutes, yeah, AI is going to do that for you.
Well, I think one of the things also to consider is just what this means to society. I mean, it's just like, you know, on one hand, it's like, I'm thinking, oh, all these really boring jobs are going to go away. Well, what about all the people who have these boring jobs? You know,
well, I mean, we asked that question in the 1800s when we had factories that became turned to automation, you know, new jobs form.
Yes,
exactly. Yes, exactly.
Yes. Yeah, but it's one of the things that's going to be a concern.
Well, there's always consequences. Tom, let me put it this way. I do not mean to insult you whatsoever. People that are worried about the low paying jobs are completely naive. What they don't realize is that we're freeing labor to do other low paying jobs that now need to be done that weren't required before. And the consequences are change, and change is inevitable, except from a vending machine. So we have to be able to realize that, you know, through all history, we have had changes at the menial level of jobs. Always. It has always been ongoing, and there was always another menial job for somebody to have. And those that will always be guaranteed gainful employment that's interesting are those that operate at the managerial and strategic level. So yeah, there will be changes, but also keep in mind, we have a whole new array of tasks that we haven't invented yet. And so I can show you in history over and over and over and again, how that happened.
No, I think that's a good way to explain it, because it's just like, you know, I mean, think what agriculture was like before all of these giant machines showed up. I mean,
half the population fed the other half the population.
Right. And that's just not the case. And you don't
1%,
have all these,
not even. Yeah.
And you know, you don't have all these people out that are, you know, they can't find jobs because they can't work in a field sort of thing. It's like, no, that's not the case. No, I think you're right.
I do. So just to close, because I know we're getting a bit tight on time, guys, and I want to finish just before, because it's always good to be on time. So yeah, I personally agree with you guys. I think that.
Oh, you're such a suck up.
No, I do though, because I've been thinking about this for ages, right? Like mechanized farming and, you know, like all of these revolutions. Yeah. And the fact is that unless you take the time to be strategic in your thinking, unless you upskill yourself to learn what you need to learn, you're basically going to be always suffering at that bottom level of work, right? And there will be loads of new jobs. There are new jobs already, right? And you need to basically just adapt and evolve. And if you're not adapting and evolving and trying to learn as much as you can about what you're really excited about, because look, if you're not excited about what you're doing, then at the end of the day, you're probably doing the wrong job. So
at the end of the day, you're probably drinking.
Well, yeah, and that. But the thing is that, well, it's true, right?
Yeah,
the thing is that if you are in the wrong job and you're like, well, I don't have any time. This is what people say to me, because I speak to loads of people that want to change their lives. Loads of people. They're like, well, I'm too busy. I don't have time to study. I don't have this. It's like, look, you can go and you can learn about any freaking thing that you want. You can start on YouTube, you can go to Audible, you can listen to books. And if you listen to 10 or 20 books, right, in say 6 months or a year, you're going to know more than most people out there about that specific topic. And then you can go into that specific thing, but you've got to start with excitement. It must excite you. If it doesn't excite you, like a child would be excited if you gave them a specific gift that they were interested in, don't do it. And that's my final close on the whole thing, to sum up everything in jobs. You know,
you're spot on. If you don't have time, it's a priority issue. And if you don't have time, you will have time very soon. Involuntarily.
Yeah, very, very true. And let's hope that everything's okay for you in the meantime. But guys, I wanted to just say, I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you. And I can't thank you enough for making the time to be on this podcast. I will drop the links to your websites in the show notes. And thank you very much.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.